Chapter 3, The Qualities of the Will. Before we embark on a detailed examination of the four major aspects of the will and how they can be developed by training, it will be useful to review the qualities of the will. If we study the phenomenology of will in action, that is, characteristics displayed by willers, we find a number of qualities which are outstanding in the great willers and which also exist in some measure, however small, in each of us, and, if necessary, can be aroused from latency to manifestation. These qualities are likely to be more familiar to most readers than the aspects. The qualities of the will are 1. Energy, dynamic power, intensity. 2. Mastery, control, discipline. 3. Concentration, one-pointedness, attention focus. 4. Determination, decisiveness, resoluteness, promptness. 5. Persistence, endurance, patience. 6. Initiative, courage, daring. 7. Organization, integration, synthesis. From the standpoint of training the will, it is necessary to first have the various qualities clearly in view, to know them and to understand them thoroughly. Then they can be evoked as necessary, in the right proportions and in the proper mode as the situation demands. Different qualities are more closely associated with the specific aspects and stages of will. And here we have a footnote. The stages of the willed act, as it unfolds from start to finish, are purpose, deliberation, decision, affirmation, planning, and the direction of the execution. The full discussion of these stages is in part 2 of this volume. So that's the end of that footnote, continuing again with the text. And we shall discuss these concurrences as we proceed. It should also be remembered that some of the qualities are closely related to each other and overlap to some extent, such is the case, for example, with the qualities of mastery, concentration, decisiveness, and initiative. Other qualities instead have opposite characteristics. The fully developed will knows how to use these differing qualities alternately as needed or to achieve a balance between them by following a wise middle path. Sometimes, for example, the best completion of a willed act calls for the balancing of decisiveness and daring on one hand and discipline and persistence on the other. 1. Energy, dynamic power, intensity. This quality is the naturally outstanding characteristic of the strong will. It is the one quality which is generally attributed to the will and with which the will is often identified. But it is not the only quality of the will. And if it is not associated with the other qualities and balanced by the action of other psychological functions, it is apt to defeat its own purposes. This quality, taken by itself, can have harmful and even disastrous effects on both the willer himself and the targets of his willful actions. Such effects occur when the will is used in a domineering, oppressive, forbidding way. It has been called the Victorian will because it was widely used in that period, particularly in the field of education. It is such misuse that has brought the will into disrepute, producing a violent reaction against it which has swung to the other extreme, a tendency to refuse any kind of control and discipline of drives, urges, wishes, whims, a cult of unbridled spontaneity. Thus, a proper understanding of the will includes a clear and balanced view of its dual nature, two different but not contradictory poles. On one hand, the power element needs to be recognized, appreciated, if necessary, strengthened, and then wisely applied. At the same time, it must be recognized that there are volitional acts which do not necessarily require effort. On the basis of experimental research, Aveling and others have observed that a volition ensuing even in difficult action may be absolutely effortless. It can be said that particularly the stages of intention, evaluation, and choice
can be effortless. Moreover, there is another and higher condition in which the personal will is effortless. It occurs when the willer is so identified with the transpersonal will, or at a still higher and more inclusive level with the universal will, that his activities are accomplished with free spontaneity, a state in which he feels himself to be a willing channel into and through which powerful energies flow and operate. This is wu-wei, Taoistic state, mentioned by Maslow in The Farther Reaches of Human Nature. Understanding the existence of the two poles of the will, one can deal without resistances or misunderstandings with its power element. This is a direct existential experience which, as previously mentioned, is realized when there is conflict or effort due to opposing conditions or forces that one wills to overcome. One is then clearly aware of, he can feel the measure of intensity of the will needed for overcoming opposing forces. This is analogous to, and is felt in the same direct way as, the way an athlete feels the degree of muscular effort that he must make in order to jump above a high obstacle. 2. Mastery, control, discipline. This quality of the will is closely connected with the first, both because mastery and control require energy and effort, and because one of the chief uses of the energy of the will is to exercise control over the other psychological functions. Control and discipline are qualities which, at present, often arouse diffidence and antagonism. Again, it is due to an extreme reaction against their previously excessive and mistaken enforcements. Control does not mean repression or suppression. Repression implies unconscious condemnation or fear, or both, and the consequent endeavor to prevent the repressed material from emerging from the unconscious to the consciousness. Suppression is the conscious and forceful elimination of unwanted material from our awareness, thus preventing its expression. Right control, however, means the regulation of expression, aiming at a guided, constructive utilization of the biological and psychological energies. Thus, in practice, wise control is often the opposite of repression and suppression. The same can be said of inhibition. Here again, the antagonism aroused by this word is due to our misunderstanding of its real meaning and function. Inhibition is not suppression. It is a temporary check of reflex actions. This is clearly recognized in the field of neurophysiology. Immediate response to stimulation is a function of the nervous centers in the spine, while one of the chief functions of the brain is that of inhibiting such reactions temporarily. This enables the stimulus to propagate to other areas of the brain, where it creates associations, often manifold and complex, which in turn make possible a higher kind of response, intelligent, well adapted, and useful. This applies not only to the physiological responses, but also to psychological actions. The point has been well stated by Maslow. An easy mistake here is to think of spontaneity and expressiveness as good always, and control of any kind as bad and undesirable. This is not so. There are several meanings of self-control, or of inhibition, and some of them are quite desirable and healthy, even apart from what is necessary for dealing with the outside world. Control need not mean frustration or renunciation of basic need gratifications. What I would call the Apollinizing controls do not call the gratification of needs into question at all. They make them more rather than less enjoyable. By example, suitable delay, as in sex, by gracefulness, as in dancing or swimming, or by aestheticizing, as with food and drink, by stylizing, as in sonnets, by ceremonializing, sacralizing, dignifying, or by doing something well, rather than just doing it. And then too, what has to be repeated again and again is that the healthy person is not only expressive. He must be able to be expressive when he wishes to be. He must be able to let himself go. He must be able to drop controls, inhibitions, defenses, when he deems this desirable. but equally he must have the ability to control himself, to delay his pleasures, to be polite to avoid hurting, to keep his mouth shut and to rein his impulses. He must be able to be either the Dionysian or Apollyon or Stoic or Epicurean, expressive or coping, controlled or uncontrolled, self-disclosing or self-concealing, able to have fun and able to give up fun, able to think of the future as well as the present. The healthy or self-actualizing person is essentially versatile. He has lost fewer of the human capabilities than the average man has. He has a large armamentarium of responses and moves towards full humanness as a limit. That is, he has all the human capacities. Control and discipline are needed in all kinds of training, both in learning necessary skills and techniques and in actualizing the unlimited amount of human potential. This means first developing weak psychological functions to a normal level and then bringing normal capacities to a higher degree of effectiveness. The point is obvious and is more or less consciously accepted and taken for granted in all forms of sport and also in the development of the technical skills necessary for artistic expression. The recognition and acceptance of the need for discipline has been expressed by a great violinist, Kubelik, I believe. If I don't practice for a day, I am aware of the difference. If I don't practice for 2 days, my friends notice it. If I don't practice for 3 days, the public remarks on it. The use of control and discipline is, of course, basic also in the training of the will itself, as will be clear in later chapters. The result of all control, discipline, and training is the achievement of mastery, which gives us both maximum effectiveness and the most intense and enduring sense of assurance, satisfaction, and joy. 3. Concentration, one-pointedness, attention, focus. This is an essential quality of the will. The lack of it can render even a strong will ineffectual, while its application may successfully compensate for a relative weakness in the force or voltage of the will. Its action is analogous to that of a lens, which by focusing the rays of the sun concentrates and intensifies the heat. Concentration is produced by attention, the function of which in the active will has been well emphasized by William James. Such attention can be called involuntary, in the sense that it can be produced by a need or prevailing interest. But when the object of the attention is non-attractive or interesting in itself, attention requires one-pointed concentration and sustained effort. An interesting anecdote illustrating the point is told by Ramchakra in his book Raja Yoga. He speaks of the famous naturalist Ajitis and his method of training pupils. His pupils became renowned for their close powers of observation and perception, and their consequent ability to think about the things they had seen. Many of them rose to eminent positions and claimed that this was largely by reason of their careful training. The tale runs that a new student presented himself to Ajitis one day, asking to be set to work. The naturalist took a fish from a jar in which it had been preserved, and laying it before the young student, bade him observe it carefully and be ready to report upon what he noticed about the fish. The student was then left alone with the fish. There was nothing especially interesting about that fish. It was like many other fishes that he had seen before. He noticed that it had fins and scales, and a mouth and eyes, yes, and a tail. In a half hour, he felt certain that he had observed all about the fish that there was to be perceived. But the naturalist remained away. As time rolled by, the youth, having nothing else to do, began to grow restless and weary. He started out to hunt up the teacher, but failed to find him, and so had to return and gaze again at that worrisome fish. Several hours had passed, and he knew but little more about the fish than he did in the first place. He went out to lunch, and when he returned, it was still a case of watching the fish. He felt disgusted and discouraged, and wished he had never come to Ajitis, who, it seemed, was a stupid old man after all, one way behind the time. Then, in order to kill time, he began to count the scales. This completed, he counted the spines of the fins. Then he began to draw a picture of the fish. In drawing the picture,
he noticed that the fish had no eyelids. Thus he made the discovery that, as his teacher had expressed it often in lectures, a pencil is the best of eyes. Shortly after, the teacher returned, and after ascertaining what the youth had observed, he left, rather disappointed, telling the boy to keep on looking, and maybe he would see something. This put the boy on his mettle, and he began to work with his pencil, putting down little details that escaped him before, but which now seemed very plain to him. He began to catch the secret of observation. Little by little, he brought to light new objects of interest about the fish. But this did not suffice his teacher, who kept him at work on the same fish for 3 whole days. At the end of that time, the student really knew something about the fish, and better than all, had acquired the knack and habit of careful observation and perception in detail. Years after, the student, then attained to eminence, is reported as saying, "That was the best zoological lesson I ever had, a lesson whose influence has extended to the details of every subsequent study, a legacy that the professor left to me, as he left to many others, of inestimable value, which we could not buy and with which we cannot part." Concentration of attention can be exercised in 3 fields or spheres of reality. It can be outward directed, as in observing some natural object like a fish, in studying an issue, or in performing an action. It can also be inner directed, when used to become aware of and to analyze subjective psychological states, one's thoughts, one's fantasies, or drives. It can also be upward directed, when the center of consciousness, the I, directs its inner gaze towards higher, superconscious processes and the transpersonal self. This last kind of concentration is needed for carrying on the inner activity of meditation and for maintaining a state of contemplation. While concentration generally, and especially at first, requires a definite act of will, after some time it can persist on its own without any effort or tension of the will itself. This is the case when one is absorbed in the contemplation of the beauty of some natural object or scenery, or is in the state called by the mystics passive contemplation, or the orison of the quiet. An important and practical use in carrying out willed acts of concentration, combined with control, consists in maintaining clearly and steadily the images and ideas of the actions one wills to perform in the field of consciousness. This implies the voluntary utilization of the motor potential inherent in images and ideas, as expressed in the psychological law. Images or mental pictures and ideas tend to produce the physical conditions and the external acts that correspond to them. Both the way this law works and how it can best be used are dealt with in the chapter on skillful will. Concentration, like all other qualities and functions, can be developed by appropriate exercises and kept at an effective level by constant use. Many exercises for developing concentration can be mentioned, but I think it is not necessary because all the exercises described in the chapter on the strong will require concentration and serve to train and develop this quality. 4. Determination, decisiveness, resoluteness, promptness. This quality of will is demonstrated chiefly in the stage of deliberation. And here we have a footnote. The stage of deliberation is in the act of will is discussed at length in chapter 13. Returning to text. The lack of decisiveness and resoluteness is one of the weaknesses of democratic systems, where deliberation can become an endless process. We know how difficult it is to induce a large assembly to arrive, if not at unanimity, at least at a majority decision. There are well-known as historical examples of this ineffectiveness of assemblies. One concerns the Roman Senate. It was said that tum Rome consilitur sigentum expungitur. While the Roman senators indulged in consultations, the enemy conquered the town of Sigentum. Another and amusing example is of the cardinals gathered for the election of a pope in Viterbo. They discussed and fought for months until finally the people became impatient and angry and uncovered the roof of the hall where the cardinals were assembled. After this, the decision was made quickly. But one must be careful not to confuse promptness and rapidity with impulsiveness. Impulsiveness doesn't stop to deliberate at all. It jumps over, so to speak, the stage of deliberation, sometimes with fatal consequences. Therefore, it is important to have deliberation, but without too much lingering. Not to decide is also a decision, and may turn out to be the worst one. Determination, decisiveness, and resoluteness are also much needed at the stage of execution of the willed act. It has been said that one of the reasons for the success of Napoleon was his rapidity of decision. The Italian philosopher Niccolò Tommaso says that resoluteness is an essential component of the strength of will. Resoluteness is closely related to another quality of the will, which we are going to consider later: initiative, courage, daring. 5.
Persistence, endurance, patience.
For certain tasks of a great length, steadfastness of purpose and persistence are needed, even more than energy. In fact, they may aptly replace energy in persons who have little physical strength. In this case, one may effectively use the technique of little and often, that is, accomplishing one's work in small installments, with short, frequent rests taken at the onset of fatigue. In such a way, Charles Darwin completed his monumental Origin of Species, thus compensating for the fact that his physical energy was so low and that he usually could not work much longer than 1 hour a day. Another kind of persistence is that exercised in spite of repeated failures. This is the secret of many successful inventors and scientists. It is said that Edison tried about 2,000 substances before finding carbon wire for making his electric bulb. Let us think how much we owe him for this extraordinary persistence. He would have been well justified if he would have given up attempts at the 1,000th or even the 500th trial. This kind of persistence can be called tenacity. Other instances of tenacity are those of authors who offer their manuscripts to several publishers in spite of repeated refusals. An outstanding and amusing example of this is that of Jules Verne, the pioneer of science fiction. When he was 25 and had just completed his first novel, he went with manuscript under arm, knocking at the door of 14 publishers, all of whom laughed in his face. Finally, the 15th, Hetzel, took the manuscript in order to read it. After 10 days, Hetzel not only pledged himself to publish the novel, but offered Verne a contract for 20 years for a book each year. The fortune of Verne was made, and also that of Hetzel. Persistence, tenacity, and repetition can also be seen in the natural world. There is a Latin saying that the drop makes a hole in the stone, not through its force, but by its constant falling. This is a principle well understood by advertisers and dictators. Like many qualities of will, persistence can be put to bad or good uses. It is successfully and well used in one technique employed by psychosynthesis: repetition. Another form of persistence is that of endurance. It is outstandingly demonstrated in the endurance of physical hardships, in sport in general, especially in mountain climbing, and recently was admirably apparent in the astronauts. It is a saving quality when one finds oneself in protracted and painful, unavoidable conditions. One outstanding example of endurance was that of Viktor Frankl's willed survival of Nazi concentration camps, vividly described in his book From Death Camp to Existentialism. Such heroic cases can help us overcome any tendency towards grumbling, self-pity, and giving up when faced with much lesser physical hardships or adverse conditions. From the existential viewpoint, the attitude of endurance can be called the willingness to accept suffering. It has been found that the refusal to accept suffering can create neurotic conditions, while generous acceptance of unavoidable suffering leads to insight, growth, and achievement. Another form of persistence is patience. This quality is generally not associated with will because of a limited understanding of what the will entails. But patience is part of the fully developed will. Many authors have patiently written and rewritten parts of their works until they were satisfied that it was as good as they could make it. Hermann Kersling was a prolific and easy writer and generally revised little or not at all. said that when he worked at what he himself rightly considered his most important work, Meditations Sudamericanas, he wrote some of the chapters 6 or 7 times each. And Hemingway, though, who also generally wrote fluently without revising, rewrote one of his short stories several dozen times. 6. Initiative, courage, daring. This quality has 2 roots. One is the recognition that full and lasting security is fundamentally an illusion. There is no complete security in our life, physical, financial, or of any other kind. So the craving for security at any cost is self-defeating. It is a bourgeois attitude, against which, at present, there is a healthy reaction, particularly among the young. Another incentive towards courage is the enhancement and stimulation given by danger or risk. This often brings a feeling of intense aliveness and clarity, and can create a true expansion of consciousness, and even an ecstatic state. Such experiences have been described by some mountain climbers, parachutists, deep sea divers, and astronauts. Of course, risks should not be reckless and thoughtless. Here also there is a danger of overdoing and taking needless chances that have no purpose except the emotional excitement they give. Courageous risk-taking is justified and appropriate when it has a well-thought-out purpose and value, but is not primarily an end in itself. 7. Organization, integration, synthesis. This quality of will is, in a certain sense, the most important, the one which enables it to fulfill its unique and specific function. This function and the way it operates may be illuminated by an analogy with a healthy body. In the body, there is a marvelous coordination of the activities of every cell, organ, and groups of organs, the function and purpose of which are to keep the body alive and active. The body allows an intelligent cooperation of each element, from the cells to the large functional systems, such as the circulatory system, the digestive, and so on. There is a complex interaction and mutual balancing of the activity of the endocrine glands, regulated by the nervous system, in order to create a condition of equilibrium and to maintain it in spite of all the disturbing impacts from the external world. Thus, the body is a unified organism, a functional unit of countless diverse parts, a perfect demonstration of unity in diversity. What is the unifying principle that makes this possible? Its real nature escapes us. We only call it life, but something can be said of its qualities and the ways of operating. They have variously been called coordination, interaction, or organic synthesis. According to the mathematician Luigi Fantapie, this principle is one of the manifestations of the general law of syntrophy, or negative entropy, of which he has given a precise mathematical formulation verified by observations. Syntropy is beginning to be recognized as a fundamental principle of nature, one having far-reaching universal implications. Buckminster Fuller states, "My continuing philosophy is predicated first on the assumption that in counterbalance to the expanding universe of entropically increasing random disorderliness, there must be a universal pattern of omni-contracting, convergent, progressive orderliness, and that man is that anti-entropic, reordering function." Teilhard de Chardin gives ample evidence of this law, which is at the basis of all evolution, biological, psychological, and spiritual, and produces what he calls complexification and convergence. He describes the various stages of this process of synthesis, which in humanity becomes conscious, toward and including a super-individual. And here we have a footnote. Here, a semantic clarification is needed in order to avoid confusion and misunderstandings. While psychologists such as Jung use the term individuality to describe higher aspects of the human being to be attained through what they call the process of individuation, Teilhard de Chardin, adopting the terminology generally used by Christian writers, uses the words personality and the process of personalization to describe the higher aim above and beyond the individual, returning to text, and cosmic center, which he calls the omega point. If we consider this process from within, we find that we can have a conscious existential experience of it. We can experience it as an intelligent energy directed toward a definite aim, having a purpose. There are also the specific characteristics of the will as an expression of the synthesizing self. We need not discuss how the unifying synergetic force operates at the biological levels. What matters is to realize that we can be aware of its higher manifestations in the conscious human being, and also at transpersonal levels. This quality of the will operates in various ways. First, as an inner synergy, coordinating the various psychological functions. It is the unifying force which tends toward, enables one to achieve, personal psychosynthesis. It is also active at the transpersonal level and works towards the unification of the personal center of consciousness, the I, or ego, with the transpersonal self, leading to the corresponding harmonious cooperation of the personal will with the transpersonal will, transpersonal or spiritual psychosynthesis. The will demonstrates synergy also in the outer activities of the individual, in his acts of willing, both in coordinating and organizing these activities through planning and programming, the fifth stage of the will in action, and directing and regulating the successive phases of their execution, sixth stage. The operation of the laws of cooperation, organization, and synthesis is evident not only in the intrapersonal realm, but also in the large field of interpersonal relationships, from the couple to all social groups, and finally the whole of humanity. Its expressions have been variously called empathy, identification, love, social will. It tends to transcend the opposition between the individual and society, the selfish-unselfish polarity. Maslow called the transcendence of this dichotomy the creation of a superordinate unity. Finally, there is the planetary and cosmic synergy, which, by analogy, can be surmised to be the expression of the deliberate action of the will of corresponding transhuman principles or entities. As Teilhard de Chardin asserts, this, according to him, is the logical necessary goal of the whole evolutionary process. I had arrived at the same conclusion before knowing Teilhard de Chardin's writings, and had expressed it in my paper Psychoanalysis and Psychosynthesis, published in 1934 in the Hibbert Journal, and later included in my book Psychosynthesis, under the title Dynamic Psychology and Psychosynthesis. From a still wider and more comprehensive point of view, universal life appears to us as a struggle between multiplicity and unity, a labour and an aspiration towards union. We seem to sense that, whether we conceive it as a divine being or as cosmic energy, the spirit working upon and within all creation is shaping it into order, harmony and beauty, uniting all beings, some willing, but the majority as yet blind and rebellious, with each other through links of love, achieving slowly and silently, but powerfully and irresistibly, the supreme synthesis. End of chapter 3. Roberto Assagioli, The Act of Will, A Guide to Self-Actualization and Self-Realization.